He kōna i purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, haere mai, piki mai, kaki mai, kia ora and welcome to 30 with Guy and Espinner. 30 minutes, one guest, no cuts. What we record is what you get. Roseanne Liang is a New Zealand film director going global. Her next movie stars Halle Berry and Angelina Jolie. But she first made her name with a very personal story. The cross-cultural relationship with the Pākehā man who became her husband, My Wedding and Other Secrets. It became something of a cultural touchstone for the experience of Asian New Zealanders. And in her work, Roseanne has tackled the politics of race relations, made girl power action adventures like Shadow in the Cloud, and the dystopian World Without Men TV comedy series Creamery. So what's next? Let's start the clock, 30 minutes, with Roseanne Liang. Kia ora, Roseanne, welcome to 30.
Kia ora, Guy.
Thanks very much for coming in. Let's start with the what next, and then we can sort of roll on to how it is that you got to be where you are today. Your next movie, Maud vs. Maud, what can you tell me about that?
I can't tell you that much about it. It is a closely guarded Warner Brothers studio movie with Angelina Jolie and Halle Berry, and it's a spy versus spy thriller action fun movie, which has been described as a Bond versus Bourne mashup between the two of them. Yeah.
Well, that's not a bad start.
Yeah. I mean, it's my cup of tea. Yeah, clearly. Yeah.
And how did that come about?
It was a confluence of some really amazing events. So I got Hollywood representation back in 2017 when a short action movie that I made called Do No Harm sort of broke out in Sundance and South by Southwest that year. I got agents, managers. I signed with one of the biggest agencies in America called WME. And my former agent left WME to become Halle's business partner. And then she always remembered me, and when this project came across their desk, then they reached out to me, and I did the pitch, and I, you know, talked to both of these incredible women, and we decided that we'd step out together and make this movie together. Yeah.
And is it, you've done sort of feminist action movies, if you like, before, and is that the sort of tone?
It's it's a big studio movie. Like the Bond versus Bourne thing, you know, La Femme Nikita meets Mission Impossible and Bond, the best of Bond. I'd say the Daniel Craig kind of era of Bond.
Not the Sean Connery era.
Well, I mean, I guess it's dated, and this is very much a modern movie about gender equality, about women and feminism, but also just a really great muscular action movie that happens to star two of the most incredible female actors and action stars of our time.
And are you just getting underway with this project?
Yeah, we are. So it's under lock and key, so I can't say too much about it yet.
Well, you got me with the pitch anyway.
Yeah, yay!
It sounds exciting.
Yeah.
There's another universe for you, though, isn't there, where kind of none of this happens, right? Like, your two sisters did medicine, you got into medical school, and then, as I understand it, you deferred that for a year to study film theory. So this sort of path, you nearly never went down, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a sliding doors type moment, you know, around the early 2000s, you know, or the late, actually, 90s. There's a sliding doors moment where I'm about to become to commit to 7 years of undergrad at medical school, and then I just happened to go off into that. Then I was interested in Pixar, so I did computer science and arts, and then got seduced by the dark side of the arts and then gave up my place in medical school. So, and I haven't looked back since, and honestly, I think about the other version of me who's a doctor right now, and I don't want to be smug, but I'm quite happy with this particular reality for me, yeah.
Because your parents are both doctors, right?
A doctor and a nurse,
yeah. both in the medical field, born in Hong Kong. That you've described yourself as a classic immigrant child overachiever. Is that what you were?
Yeah, I was very geared towards receiving good grades. And yes, some of that work ethic was instilled in me by my parents, because when you come to a new country, you want to really make the most of the opportunities that are there for you. But I was also a bit of a self, you know, flagellator as well. I really wanted to do a good job. My two sisters were very, you know, scary, like very impressive.
You did say scary.
I did say, no, scary in the best way, that they were both ducks of St. Cuthbert's before me.
Weren't you too though?
I was, but I got to tell you, that was a horrible
year. So three sisters, all duckses.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And there was 4 years between me and the middle sister. And yeah, by the time I reached seventh form, as it was called back then, or year 13, then
I remember it.
It was horrible. Yeah.
It strikes me, it must have taken a lot of courage with that to live up to, if you like, with your sisters and the medical profession and all the sort of pride that parents may attach to that, to go and do something crazy like film.
Yeah. Yes and no, because what's the best thing about being the youngest of three daughters is that the expectations get, chipped away as you get down the line. So by the time I was, you know, my sisters had worn down my parents. And in fact, I credit my sisters with asking me the question, why are you applying to medical school? Like, why are you going to medical school? Like, that they were already in medical school and they were like, why are you doing it? And I was like, I don't know, because you guys are doing it and I want to talk with you, you know, when around the dinner conversation, I want to participate. And they were like, that's a terrible reason to become a doctor. Maybe you should think about doing something that you choose. And that's how this whole sliding doors thing happened.
Yeah, and I love that metaphor of the sliding door. But what was the catalyst? I mean, what was the point where you're kind of messing around with film and video to the point that it becomes quite a serious career option?
It's almost like you're peeking behind the curtain, and I realised I've been a film lover, I've been a cinema lover for quite, I'd already been one from the age that I was like 3 years old and like telling my dad of how much I loved The Empire Strikes Back to like when I was 16 years old, I pretended not to speak English to get into an R18 movie. And that movie was Pulp Fiction because it had won the Palme d'Or that year. I pretended not to speak English and I cashed in on my parents to get an R18 ticket to watch it. And that was a seminal experience for me. What an incredible non-linear film. And when I went to university and studied critical theory, I realised that I was like, I love this. I could deep dive in this and swim in this for the rest of my life. And that's, you know, again, I have to credit the university's film and TV teachers and lecturers and staff in instilling that seed in me that I could actually do this. I've loved it for the longest time. I'm a consumer, but I could actually do this.
And you have to be, right? You have to be a voracious consumer of film to become a filmmaker.
I think so. You have to really love it. You have to be slightly crazy in love with it. You have to be obsessed with it in a way, because the work is not going to sustain you. It's not. You don't do it for the money. You don't do it for the glory. You do it because you genuinely are obsessed with it, and you know it sustains you and it keeps your energy up.
And then we see you really start to make your name with your first documentary, or the documentary Banana in a Nutshell.
Yeah.
Firstly, for the uninitiated, what is a banana in this context? I mean,
it's a racial term. It is one used by Chinese, well, in my case, by Chinese to describe a certain type of Chinese person, which is a Chinese person that's grown up in a Western society. And so banana refers to white on the inside, yellow on the outside. And it's a problematic term, not used in the nicest of ways.
But if you're using it about yourself, you're allowed to, right?
Well, I wanted to reclaim it, so so that's why I put it in the title, yeah.
Yeah, and this effectively is a story about you meeting and dating Stephen Harris, who becomes your husband.
Yeah.
How did your parents react to that?
Initially not well. It was a very tense time in my life. And I had made the documentary almost as a way to understand why this was happening to me and why my parents weren't communicating to me in a way that I was used to. Like, other parents said, "I love you and I'm proud of you," to their friends. I saw them do it. But my parents never said that to me, and I wanted to know, do you actually not like me? Do you not, what is this? Why are you treating me like this, and why are you putting so many roadblocks in my way? And then I realised through the process of making the movie, it became a realisation that I'm the dick here. Like, they've been saying they love me all this time. They push me on my grades because they know that I'm capable of it. They know that I can be excellent. So that's the absolute least that they'll accept from me. The first question my mother asks when I got home, because I was living at home until my mid-20s, was, you know, "Are you hungry?" And that is a way of saying I love you. And I hadn't seen it all this time. I'd been blind. And, you know, in some ways I'd been blinded by my upbringing to not be able to decipher their love language. And that became quite a sense of embarrassment for me through making that movie. And I, in a way, the movie became a love letter to them to say, "I see you, I hear you now, and I can now translate what you've been saying to me all this time."
How did they react, though, to the documentary? It's hard, isn't it, when you're an artist or a creative person in any sense,
yeah,
and you bring your family in. I mean, there's that famous advice to writers of write like your parents are dead.
I haven't heard that one.
Well, in other words, don't hold anything back.
Right.
You're going to upset people, but tell your authentic story, I suppose.
Yeah, and they're not used to that, but and they weren't. You know, I think there was a lot of... There was definitely stress and strife there. But as the years went on and as that project, you know, was made into another film...
Well, this becomes My Wedding and Other Secrets,
yeah,
doesn't it? Which,
yeah,
was very successful.
Yes.
And became the sort of feature film that was spawned out of that, right?
Yeah, that was my first dramatic feature film, first scripted film, that SPP came to me when they saw the success that the documentary had done. Then they said, John Barnett said, "Do you want to make this into a feature film?" And of course, this is a dream.
Yeah.
This is an absolute dream. I'm a few years out of film school, and to have, you know, the studio that made Whale Rider coming to you and saying, "Do you want to make a film?"
So you were still in your 20s at that point?
Yeah. Yeah. I was still, I was just moving into, I was 30 when I made, 31 when I made My Wedding and Other Secrets.
And it's the first full feature film made by a Chinese New Zealander, right?
Yeah.
So you had,
yeah,
what role models? Virtually none, really, in New Zealand.
Yeah, I guess I didn't, but I didn't, I don't know, I thought, I knew it on an intellectual level, but it didn't worry me, because I guess, you know, my parents had always taught me that, you know, just because it's never been done before doesn't mean that it can't be done. Like, that instilled, or my education, whether it was, you know, Meadowbank Primary School, St Cuthbert's College, and then Auckland University, somehow I'd had this fearlessness drilled into me, is that just because it's the first time someone has done it means that you shouldn't be afraid of it. And I wasn't. I was like, well, yeah, this is where I'm meant to be. I have a lot to prove. I think maybe that's the biggest thing, is that the drive to be excellent and to make it really good is probably the hardest thing about it. But me being there isn't a surprise to me necessarily.
The cross-cultural tension that you dive into in the documentary and then the film about your relationship with your husband, I mean, this was the late 90s, I guess, that you met. Would it still be like that today? Does that tension still exist, do you think, for Asian New Zealanders?
For some and not others. I think it's still, the societal and generational issues still exist for some people, but then other people have moved on and you just never know. I think people are still discovering Banana in a Nutshell and My Wedding and Other Secrets, and I know this because they send me emails and they'll say, "I'm going through this with my partner," and it's not just, you know, obviously it's a Kiwi Chinese person with a New Zealand Caucasian, but people will see their own relationships, whether it's a queer relationship or Israeli with Palestinian, or it's these cross-cultural divides and strifes happen all over the world, and they're still happening. So yeah, it's less relevant in some ways because culture has moved on, but it's still relevant to some people.
Mm. I mean, fellow film director Taika Waititi famously said in 2018 that New Zealand was the best place on the planet, but it was a racist place that people just flat out refused to pronounce Māori names properly. Yeah. That generated a lot of discussion. Do you think in 2024 that New Zealand is a racist place? Would you agree with that statement?
Oh, that's such a loaded statement. It's such a loaded statement, Guyan, because I can't win. It feels like a lose-lose situation. There are racial divides in this country that have not been solved yet, and some of them are getting worse. But there are leaps and bounds that have also been made. So I'm not going to sit here and say New Zealand is a racist country. There are racist people, and there's more of them than is safe.
Is it something you have come up against in your career and in your experience?
Yes, but I also need to acknowledge that my experience is different to Māori and Indigenous and tangata whenua, which is generational. I've been one generation in New Zealand, and I've had so many great opportunities in my lifetime that from New Zealand that I'm so grateful for. But I'm also very aware that there are generational issues for others that have not been dealt with and are in danger of never being dealt with and actually getting worse. Like, I thought when we learned about the civil rights movement in America, you know, at school in the 90s, I thought, oh, in the 1960s, the civil rights movement was solved. And from 2016, but before that, but especially 2016, that has proven to be not the case. History is a circle, and it's frighteningly so, and we have to be ever vigilant. Like the constant gardener, we have to be constantly gardening and still sowing the seeds and watering the seeds and growing this garden, you know, and we have to be constantly vigilant so that we don't go backwards.
Are you political in your filmmaking, do you think?
Yes, I am.
As well as being entertaining.
Yes, that. I think, you know, no one wants to be force-fed things that are good for them, if you know what I mean. Like, they don't, like, why do I go to the movies? I go to the movies because I want to commune with humanity and I want to have hope for humanity, for me. I'm not interested in seeing movies that are primarily about humans eating each other because I see that on the news every day. I see that in my feed every day, people eating each other. I don't need that in my movies. Yes, I'm not a Pollyanna in that I understand that there is a dark heart in every human. Like, you know, within seconds we could be trying to kill each other in the right circumstances. I'm not threatening you. but we can become the most savage versions of ourselves in very little time. You know, being fascinated with violence and action, which I am, I've talked to people in the army and special forces people, and it's very scary how animals are panicky. Humans are panicky animals. There's a great line from Men in Black 2, where Will Smith character is asking, you know, why can't we just tell people that aliens exist? You know, people are smart. And who's the other actor? The older actor. Someone help me. Three-barreled
name. Control room will help us.
The older actor goes to Will Smith.
Is it Tommy Lee Jones?
It's Tommy Lee Jones. Tommy Lee Jones goes, A person is smart, but people are panicky animals and you know it. You can't trust humanity as a whole because we're a big sort of, you know, race of panicky animals. And anyway, sorry, I've gone off on a...
No, you haven't, because I find this fascinating about you, because you once said that action movies can make us feel a connection to humanity that no other cinema can.
Yeah.
And I just didn't really think about action movies in that way.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that? Keep going with that.
Well, because violence is part of being human. Violence is going to visit us whether we like it or not. And I say this... And not to say this not about men, but especially for women, the threat of violence is always around me. When I walk to my car at night, when I'm in my car at the traffic lights, violence is something that I think about subconsciously all the time.
So does that, seeing action movies with violence but knowing it's not real, does that somehow dissipate or reduce that fear? Well, what is it? What's this connection with humanity that you talk about?
When action really hits, and most action is very escapist and superficial, and I say I love action cinema, and I love most action cinema, but the ones that I watch again and again are a very thin strata of action movies that hit on spectacle, heart and smarts, and movies that sit in that strata, very thin level, are films like Terminator 2, Aliens, because they deal with this idea that despite our violent hearts, humanity has value. And I think that's when action really speaks to me.
I heard that you watch Terminator 2 every year. Well, you certainly watch it a few times.
Yeah, I watch it a lot. Yeah.
And are you trying to do some of that with your own filmmaking?
100%. You know, when you think of a big tentpole action movie done by a studio, you think, oh, I'm just popcorn and I leave my boring life and I go into this beautiful, exciting world when I'm safe and the knowledge that none of this will ever happen to me. But I don't see it that way. I see cinema as truth. Cinema is a mirror of humanity. Cinema is our darkest dreams and our deepest fears and also our fantasies as well for a better life and a better existence. So I put action movies very much in that, you know, it's all about going deep. The best action movies are deep. Even Die Hard is deep. It's about a guy who wants to reconcile with his wife.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, when we think about those action movies that we all watch year upon year at Christmas or whenever, the best ones are the ones that are deep, the ones that say something about humanity. And I think it's unwise to sort of dismiss all action movies as dross that we can forget about. Yes, some of them we forget about, but some of them stay with us for forever.
Let's talk about Creamery. You've had, what, 2 seasons of that?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Is there going to be another one?
We've got,
or is this another
we've got development.
Agreement?
We've got a development deal for Creamery, but we haven't received production finance.
Were you surprised it found such an audience in the US and Australia? It's quintessentially Kiwi, but
yes.
Were you surprised at the resonance abroad?
I was delighted, I think. I every time I make something, I wish that it could have that effect that the season one of Creamery did. And it doesn't always happen. And I become disappointed, but I tell myself that the work is its own reward. This time, the work was its own reward, and it seemed to really resonate with people in the way that I hoped it would. And so, yeah, when did it come out? 2021? 2020?
2020, I think it came
2020
out.
2020, it came out. Yeah. So we'd just been making it. We'd been making it during the pandemic, and it just hit at a time where I feel the audience was ready for it. Yeah.
It's this. They even have a genre name for this: World Without Men.
There's a few
genre.
Of them.
The New York Times review said that the unspoken question is how women would act if they were in charge, and the answer seems to be that they would be very mean.
Yeah, maybe. They'd be very human. I mean, meanness is, to be mean is to be human. What's meanness, you know? Mean, by another name, would be, you know, looking out for myself. So what do you do with that?
Yeah.
You know?
But you want to make another season of that if you can.
Oh, definitely. I've been thinking, you know, we've actually got it all outlined. We kind of know where we want to go. It'll be the final season. So it will wrap up the story, and it really, ultimately, I really want it to say something about this thing that Jonathan Glazer mentioned, you know, his very controversial speech at the Oscars about how do we resist dehumanization while we're trying to fix the world without becoming the thing that we're trying to fix. You know, how do we resist dehumanization? And that's a perennial, and not just perennial, but more urgent now than it has ever been.
Yeah, there's a lot of urgency there. AI, climate change, there's so many, war, as we've talked about. And you've sort of embraced some of these dystopian visions. I mean, dystopia, are we headed there?
As far as I can tell, yes. I don't know how we're going to get out of it. Like if it's not people, if it's not people eating each other, it's the climate, you know, just changing on us and the world dying because of we can't, you know, we can't change it. Even though we know what's happening, it's like the Greek Cassandra, you know, myth. It's like we're doomed to know what is going to happen to us, but have no power to change it. You know, fate. Fate is coming for us and there's nothing we can do. It feels like there's nothing we can do.
You did an undergrad in computer science. I think
yes.
You touched on that before. and now you're a highly successful filmmaker, but sort of computer science is chasing you in some ways with AI. I mean, you were caught up in the Hollywood writer's strike, I imagine. I mean,
yes.
And part of that was, part of the sticking point was, what is the place of artificial intelligence in script writing in movies? How do you get a sense that AI might change things? I mean, you see these things like Stora now, which is the text prompt version of ChatGPT, but a video version where you can type in a scene and up it comes, which
yeah.
is utterly extraordinary.
Yeah.
How do you see that impacting on your industry?
I think it could put people out of jobs, but I think that I'm personally not panicking about it right now. I'm not panicking about it because it's got some ways to go. I don't think that even with the incredible tests that are happening, this is the inception, this is the beginning, the emergence.
It's only about a year old. It's an infant, isn't it?
It's an infant, and it's definitely going to grow. And yes, you know, people are saying, well, it'll be writing scripts that you can't tell the difference from a human writer within, that's already here, and they're hiding it from us, and we're going to find out what that's going to look like, you know, very soon when they decide to unleash it on the world. But until I see that, until I see a good script, it's hard enough for a human to write a good script without, you know, so you, most of the AI is based on large language models or you know, billions of pieces of, what are they trained on? If you put in all the Oscar winning and all the best scripts into this pot and then AI generates it, like Ted Chiang, the famous American science fiction writer, said that it's not AI, it's applied statistics. It's just a large language model of billions of pieces of data, and AI spits out a version of that with some prompts. And so am I worried that AI is going to replace me? Well, AI hasn't lived my life. AI hasn't lived the life of, you know, other great writers out there. So until I see AI scoop something out of the ether of human experience that says something to me about humanity that I've always known but I've never seen expressed in that way, I don't know if AI can do it. And when AI does it, when or if it does it, if it helps me understand more about what it is to be a human and to exist in this realm of reality, bring it on. If you can blow my mind with a story that's written by AI and it's really good and it means something and it transforms me like a piece of art could transform me, I don't care where it comes from. You know, if it comes from AI, if it comes from billions of other writers who've been incredible writers, then what does it matter where it came from?
Just a couple of minutes to go. What's the dream movie that you haven't made yet? I once read that you wanted to make a sort of James Cameron type extravaganza.
Yeah, I might get the chance to make it. Obviously, I am in the process of getting to make it now. But I mean, Terminator 2. I once had the great fortune to interview James Cameron, and I told him point blank, I was like, Terminator 2 is the pinnacle of the mountain that I'm climbing, you know, or a movie like it. If I could make a movie like Terminator 2, then that would be it for me. Like, I think. Then I could. I mean, I can still die happy. I've had a very good life, but I could die happy after that. Yeah, if I get to make a movie like Terminator 2.
Thank you very much for your time. Thanks very much for coming into 30.
Yeah, thanks for
Roseanne Liang. It was 30 minutes with Roseanne Liang, and this is 30 with Guy and Espina. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening. If you like this show, please remember to follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts. You can find our other episodes on our show page, rnz.co.nz/guyon. 30 with Guy and Espina is presented and researched by me, Guy and Espina. The executive producer is Ali Ventura. The producer is Richard Larson. Post-production by Cole Essen Farrelly. The audio engineer is Blair Stagpool. Our designers are Jane Joyce and Tom Crampin. Operations manager is Jamie Anan, and a special thanks to Whakaata Māori Studios.